Welcome to this Wednesday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. We are glad you are with us today. And May is National Beef Month. And Dr. Eric Berg from NDSU's Animal Science Program will join us in a bit on Prairie Plates, and he'll share his grilling tips, his meat science insights, and the sizzle behind steak perfection. He'll also give us his thoughts on his favorite backyard grills, and he'll talk about an upcoming grilling event on Monday, May 19th at Family Wellness here in Fargo. As we begin Main Street today, we have a plan to delve into the life of Edwin Land, the visionary behind Polaroid camera, before the digital age, Land's innovations and revolutionary photography allowed instant image development, and the upcoming American Experience documentary, Mr. Polaroid, which premieres on May 19th at 8 p.m. here on the television service of Prairie Public and on PBS stations across the country, explores his journey. Joining us is Ron Feirstein, author of A Triumph of Genius, Edwin Land, Polaroid, and the Kodak Patent War, and he provides deep insights into Land's legacy. It is a pleasure to welcome you to Main Street, Ron.
Hi, Craig. Nice to be here. Thank you for having me.
Before we get into the nuts and bolts of what the documentary is about and what even Mr. Land's history is about, how did you become attached to his life?
Well, it was a bit of an accident, but I was a young lawyer at a patent litigation firm in New York back in the late 70s, and our firm represented Polaroid in a patent dispute with Kodak, and I was assigned to that case and worked on that case for several years. And as part of my experience there, I actually got to work with Dr. Land directly and spent some time with him, and was always impressed by his genius, by his career, which frankly I knew very little about before that experience. And I sort of put it on my bucket list when I left the practice of law and went on to a career in the entertainment business that someday I'd like to go back and revisit that and write Land's story and the story of the relationship between these two iconic companies.
I should note that Polaroid alleged that Kodak's instant photography system infringed on 10 of Polaroid's patents. The case lasted more than a decade, and in 1985, a judge ruled in Polaroid's favor, and in 1990, Kodak agreed to pay $925 million in damages, one of the largest settlements of its kind at the time. And then after that, of course, Kodak was forced to stop selling its instant cameras and film.
That was the extraordinary part of it, really, Craig. The fact that we were able to get an injunction against Kodak further infringing those patents, which meant that despite the fact that 13 million Americans had Kodak cameras in their homes, Kodak was prohibited from selling film for them anymore. And all of those cameras immediately became pieces of junk.
Let's hit the rewind button now on Edwin Land, if we could. His early experiences really started by trying to address things like headlight glare, and then that seemed pivotal. How did those shape his innovative trajectory, if you will? And we're talking back in the 40s?
Oh, way before the 40s. We're talking about the 20s. Land was always a precocious young man, interested in technology, interested in science. There are stories about him as a young boy taking apart devices in his home, like their early record player, and just to see how it worked. Unfortunately, he was usually not able to put it back together again, much to the chagrin of his father. But when he was a young man, he became interested in light. He was at a summer camp, and the counselor demonstrated an Iceland spar crystal, which is a big piece of rock that could take the glare out of bright light. And at that camp, they had a near miss accident. He was out with his friends on a horse and buggy and an early automobile, because we're talking about the 1920s here. Probably 1922, 1923. Early car was coming the opposite direction with very bright headlights, and they almost had an accident. So it occurred to Land, well, maybe this big piece of rock could take away the glare and solve that problem. And that became a quest for him that lasted decades, literally decades, trying to find a way to solve the problem of automobile headlight glare.
How did he turn then to this idea of photography? And he had a big idea about photography, thought it would change the world.
After years of research, Land was able finally to come up with a material, a thin piece of plastic that could duplicate the effect of the big, large crystal rock. It was called a polarizer. And it actually was an amazing invention that he made when he was 19 years old, because this was something that physicists had been trying to come up with for hundreds and hundreds of years, and no one could. But Land solved the problem. He dropped out of Harvard to create a company based upon it. And actually, although he was never able to sell the product to Detroit for automobiles, he was able to sell it to a lot of other people. He sold it to Kodak, who made camera lenses, polarizing filters. He, more importantly, sold it to American Optical, who made sunglasses. And really, this is the same material that you have in your polarizing sunglasses today. But he invented it. He was 19 years old, dropped out of Harvard, and created a company that became a fairly large, successful company, especially during World War II, when the government realized that he could make all kinds of special equipment for the war effort. And he did. But the war was coming to an end. And in the mid-40s, around 43, 44, he realized that this major market, government sales, was going to dry up. But by this time, he had created this company that was full of talent, full of engineers, full of physicists, scientists, that really could tackle any scientific technological problem. But he knew he needed something else to focus on. He was on vacation in December 1943 in New Mexico, went for a walk with his three-year-old daughter. And they're taking photographs with a Kodak camera. They finished and he said, let's go home and we'll bring this to the pharmacy and get it developed. And the daughter started jumping up and down. No, Daddy, I want to see the pictures right away. I want to see them now. And you know, most dads would just dismiss that as the ramblings of some young kid, but it sparked something with Edwin Land. And in that moment, he decided, you know what? I'm going to find a way to create a camera and film system to give you your photographs instantaneously.
I should point out, Kodak ultimately started selling film to Polaroid. Isn't that correct?
Well, when Polaroid Land took several years, but by 1948, he had a camera to sell. The problem was making film is a very complicated process, and Polaroid had no way to do that themselves. So they went to Kodak to manufacture the film for the Polaroid cameras. In fact, Kodak manufactured all film for all Polaroid cameras from the 40s all the way into to the late 60s, early 70s. By that time, Polaroid was Kodak's second largest commercial customer. Their first largest were the cigarette companies, for whom Kodak made small plastic cylinders that they turned into cigarette filters. But Polaroid was their second largest customer.
The Polaroid Swinger, and I remember these, captured youth's imagination in the 60s. We had one in our family. What made that product resonate so profoundly with people like me when I was a kid? Was it exactly that? I could see the picture?
And the fact that, well, that's the main thing. But the fact is that it was inexpensive, or relatively inexpensive. Most of Polaroid, Land was like Steve Jobs in the sense that he really cared about the products. He wanted them to be perfect. He wanted them to be elaborate. And so most of Polaroid's early products were fairly expensive and didn't really appeal to a mass audience because of that. But the Swinger was the one that brought it to the mass audience, and everybody could own one. Everyone could afford to have one, and everyone could play with it and have their pictures instantaneously.
We're enjoying our conversation with Ron Feierstein. He's the author of A Triumph of Genius, Edwin Land, Polaroid, and the Kodak Patent War. It's in front of the upcoming American Experience documentary, Mr. Polaroid, which premieres on Monday, this coming Monday, May 19th at 8 p.m. right here on the television service of Prairie Public and on PBS stations across the country. Land's belief in technology as a social remedy is intriguing to me, especially as we live today, right? With our digital phones and our cameras and the way we use photography now. How did his philosophy manifest in Polaroid's operations and objectives way back in the day?
Well, it was about making connections between people. You know, people, look, these are early days when we didn't have the technology we have today in terms of communication, for example. There were no cell phones. It was, you know, I mean, people really lived independent lives. And yes, you would come across somebody in person and have personal interactions. But Land really saw his camera as a way of making connections between people. Here you have a picture, you can share it with someone, you can record an event, you can memorialize important parts of your life. And he also saw the artistic implications of it. Here's a way for your ordinary person to have some kind of artistic endeavor. Oh, I like the way that looks. I'm going to take a picture of that. So it was just something that enriched the lives of people in many, many ways.
Land, it seemed to me, had a commitment to inclusivity, especially involving pioneering women scientists. And that seemed to me to be ahead of his time. Did you recognize that? And how did this influence Polaroid's culture and success?
I, you know, personally, this is, you know, something I learned more about when I researched the book, as opposed to my personal experience working on the lawsuit. But it was, Land had a friend who was a professor at Smith College, and that sort of started a pipeline. You know, Land used to say, I like to take people on and train them to be scientists who don't have a lot of preconceptions. It's better sometimes that you don't have to unlearn things. And so he was happy to take women from Smith College who had backgrounds in art history or just, you know, just the general kind of appreciation of this kind of thing and train them from scratch. He would pay for them to go to school. He would pay for them to learn physics or chemistry if that was necessary. And I think to his credit, he recognized the talent of women, because these were the days long before women had equal access to things. In fact, you know, in a big way, his wife was an influence here, because when he was doing his early research on photography, he met a woman who would later become his wife, Helen Maislin. And she, with him, would sneak into the Columbia University physics labs at night and do experiments. And those were the days when actually women were not allowed in physics labs. But Land realized that was a folly. And so he loved to take on smart women and gave them positions of power and responsibility within the Polaroid company.
One more question about the lawsuit. Can you shed light, Ron, on its implications for Polaroid at the time and its implications for the broader tech industry after the judgment was rendered?
Look, Land really was a proponent of the patent system. He really believed that the patent system needed to be viable and strong in order to encourage research and development in America's tech industry. And so Polaroid had a very strong patent portfolio protecting the inventions that they made. As we discussed earlier, Kodak had been making Polaroid film all along, and they did so happily because they were making money at it. But also they did it happily because they never saw Polaroid as a challenger to their dominance of the amateur photography market until Land showed them the prototype for SX70. You know, the early cameras involved some work by the photographer. You had to pull out the picture from the camera. You had to time it. Then you had to peel it apart. Then you had to coat it with a stabilizing liquid. Then maybe you had to mount it on a piece of cardboard so it wouldn't curl up. I mean, there was a lot of work. But the holy grail, the ultimate aim, was to come up with something that would shoot out of the camera and just held it in your hand and watched it develop. Well, that was what we all know as SX70, that white framed photograph with an inch of a border at the bottom that you could write on and so forth. It wasn't until the late 60s, although the first Polaroid cameras came out in the 40s and your Swinger camera came out in the early 60s, it wasn't until 1968, 1969 that Land had a prototype for this SX70. which would solve all those problems. When he showed it to Kodak to get them to agree to help make the film for that, all of a sudden they got scared. They did their own internal research, determined they might lose $6 billion in film sales. For the first time, Polaroid seemed to perhaps become a challenger to them. And so they took a very hardline position with Polaroid and said, we're not going to make the film for you unless you let us make film for your cameras and sell it in our yellow boxes. Polaroid could not agree to that. This was David and Goliath. Kodak was the largest photographic company on the planet. Polaroid was still a relatively small niche company. They could not agree to that. And ultimately, Kodak and Polaroid went their separate ways. Polaroid went off to learn how to make film for the first time. Kodak went off to develop a camera and film system that could compete with what Polaroid was going to do.
If I remember the Kodak's camera, it was this little box thing that kind of was in a different trajectory than Polaroid's was. I always thought it looked goofy.
Well, it wasn't the elegant instrument that the Polaroid SX-M and the camera was, that's for sure. But when push, and it took them four more years, the Polaroid SX-70 came out in 1972. It wasn't until 1976 that Kodak could come out with their system. But when it came out, it looked nothing like the Polaroid SX-70. But in fact, it was determined that it used some of Polaroid's technology. And that was the basis for the patent lawsuit.
There was some controversy that came over Polaroid with their business in South Africa, which was significant. How did Land and the company navigate what turned out to be a major ethical dilemma?
Well, apartheid was was a horrible political, you know, situation in South Africa. Polaroid sold cameras in South Africa when many other companies were ceasing to do business with the country in various areas of commerce. But Polaroid continued to sell them cameras. I mean, obviously, Polaroid had no control over what they did with those cameras. And it turned out, unfortunately, that they were using those cameras to enforce their apartheid policies. And that became quite controversial, generally speaking, and particularly with the African-American workers at Polaroid. And ultimately, Polaroid recognized that and cut ties with South Africa and stopped doing business there. But it took a while and did create some controversy.
You mentioned earlier Steve Jobs, and at one time he called Polaroid the Apple of its day. In what ways did Land's approach to innovation and leadership really inspire Jobs in the end and perhaps even shape Apple's ethos?
Steve Jobs absolutely idolized Edwin Land. I mean, Edwin Land and Polaroid became the model for a lot of what Apple did. In fact, it was the Boston Globe that called Polaroid the Apple of its day. I'll just give you a little quote that I remember. It was feisty, ubiquitous, pioneering. The Polaroid camera was like the Mac, and all other consumer cameras were PCs. Polaroid stood uniquely at the intersection of science, business, and art. In the 60s, the embodiments of 60s affluence and liberation weren't bell bottoms or even birth control. They were the Ford Mustang and the Polaroid camera. I mean, wow. it was the most important and flashiest technological company in America.
I think despite even technological advancements with our cell phones and digital photography, that Polaroid's charm endures. At least that's my perception. What aspects of Land's original vision really do you think contribute to that lasting appeal? And do you agree, is Polaroid, relatively speaking, still a pretty cool company?
It's instant gratification, which is what Land recognized people wanted. People wanted instant gratification. Now, your digital cameras provide that in a way, but you can't walk away with the photograph. I mean, you can walk away with the photograph on your phone, but you can't hand it to your friend. I mean, yes, you can. I guess there are ways to transfer photographs among phones and stuff like that, but you're not holding a picture in your hand. It's on your phone. You're going to go looking for it and everything else. So Land always felt that having the print was a very important aspect of this. And, you know, to some extent, at least, that's been proven true, because Polaroid eventually did go out of business, and its logo and its trademark were sold to venture capitalists, and it had a bit of a circuitous route over the years, but now it's back in the hands of scientists and technology entrepreneurs. And they have gone about to reintroduce Polaroid. They're making film for the Polaroid camera again. And Polaroid cameras are, especially SX70 cameras, are sort of a hot commodity. This company buys them up and they refurbish them, and so there is a new market for Polaroid. To the extent you can walk away with a print as opposed to having a digital image on your camera.
Three of my grandchildren have little Polaroids, and they are just the neatest thing. And they have to budget what they're going to take a picture of, which I think is cool, instead of just snapping a million shots and then hoping you get one. But then, yeah, they get to walk away with that and watch it develop. It's like magic to them, and I think it's really cool. I want you to reflect, Ron, as we kind of wrap it up here today, on Land's journey and what lessons maybe modern innovators can glean from his success and his challenges.
I think one of the most important lessons that Land leaves us with is the idea that just about any problem can be solved if you work hard enough at it, if you dedicate yourself to it. He had many quotes about the fact that a problem wasn't even worth approaching unless it seemed impossible. And I think that was a very important aspect of his work and his personality. In fact, his wife used to complain that he would be interested in a problem until he came up with a solution. Then he would move on to something else, and he would never like completely fix whatever he was looking at. And I think another part in terms of industry and technology is that he believed that companies had an obligation to create products that their customers didn't even know they wanted, you know, and to really dream and dream big and then bring it to fruition. And I think that was one of the mantras for Polaroid. And I think you can see that certainly in Apple and many of the other technology companies of today.
Ron, what are you working on these days?
Oh, I'm working on I work with my brother, the famous playwright and actor, and we have Broadway shows and theatrical properties around the world to bring important message of equality and respect to theater audiences across the world.
Edwin Land's story intertwines innovation, ambition, and ethical considerations, offering valuable insights into the tech world's evolution. Our gratitude to our guest, Ron Feierstein, for sharing his expertise. And don't miss Mr. Polaroid on the television service of Prairie Public that airs this coming Monday, May 19th at 8 p.m. Mr. Polaroid will also be available for streaming on pbs.org. And if you want more information, go to pbs.org/American Experience. Ron, it has been a pleasure.
Thank you so much, Craig. Really appreciate your support.
Appreciate your joining us on Main Street. Still to come on Main Street, Dr. Eric Berg from NDSU's Animal Science Program. He is a grilling expert, and he joins Rick Guillen and I on Prairie Plates, and he'll share his grilling insights that are sure to make your steaks sizzle. That's ahead. Stay with us.
I like bagels.
Have some salad.
All I eat is pizza.
Eat some barbecue.
Applesauce and some nice red beets.
There's the music that reminds us it's Wednesday, and of course it's time for Prairie Plates. And it's National Beef Month. And if you're thinking about firing up the grill, there's no better guide than our guest today, Dr. Eric Berg from NDSU's Animal Sciences Department. He's not only a meat scientist with serious academic chops, he is a grilling guru who knows his way around both steaks and vegetables. And whether it's research in the lab or smoke on the grill, Dr. Berg brings sizzle to science, and he's bringing sizzle now to Prairie Plates. Welcome, Dr. Berg.
Well done.
What an intro.
Yeah,
thank you. It's great to be here.
I have been thinking about this. I attended one of your grilling events when we first moved here. And when Rick told me you were coming, it's just like, oh, geez, I'm already hungry.
Yes.
nice brisket. But of course, Rick Guillon is the host of Prairie Plates. Rick, it's good to visit with you again.
It's good to visit with you.
Dr. Berg, you are doing a grilling event on Monday, May 19th. At Family Wellness in Fargo. Is it going to be similar to the one that I was at maybe a couple years ago at the Lights?
No, it's a little more abbreviated. We're doing the gearing up for grilling starting the new grilling season and kind of a refresher course for everyone. And people might think, well, I already know all about my grills and everything, but we're going to do some fun things. And, you know, when we did the barbecue boot camp, a lot of times we talked about how I'm the research nerd, you know, that was my role there. So I said, you know, research says that people in a blind taste test can't tell the difference between a charcoal grill and a gas grill. They're going to taste the same. So we're going to do that taste test on the 19th. And hopefully we'll be able to be out in the parking lot. Otherwise, we'll be under an awning somewhere. But we're going to do that taste test and grill up some burgers and we're going to put that Blackstone grill in there that's so popular now. So we're going to try smash burgers as well.
We were talking off mic, and I have a Traeger smoker that I've had for a long time. I love it. Do a lot of different things with it. My wife is bugging me to buy a Blackstone, and I'm thinking, I don't need a Blackstone. I can do everything I need to do on the Traeger. But it sounds like maybe I ought to think about it. Why should I?
Oh, they're fun. And they kind of complete your grilling portfolio a little bit. And when I think of my Blackstone, I think of breakfast because it's so handy to have that big grill. And you cook your bacon on there and your eggs and everything is just real handy. And I'm really partial to those smash burgers on the Blackstone grill. Those are so good. And when we were talking off air, I talked about one of my favorite things to do is to take that leftover smoked pork butt. So you've got that pulled pork, throw a little butter on your Blackstone grill and fry up that leftover pulled pork on there and take some orange, slices of orange and squeeze that orange on there. Man, that's delicious.
I want to ask a simple question. What's the biggest mistake I make when I grill my steaks at home? Generally speaking,
do you overcook them?
Try not to
use a thermometer and you know, don't go over medium rare.
Attaboy.
I take mine off at 125 to let them rest. So, this is a tough question. When people they ask me, how do I properly cook my steak? Because you know, you just do it after a while, you just automatically do it. And with a steak, monitoring with your thermometer, we always talk about monitor with your thermometer, and that's going to get you the perfect steak so you don't overcook it. But after you've done a few, you're going to be able to tell. Those chefs do a touch method that you can just kind of tell. It's hard to demonstrate on the radio because it's the touch points on your hand. But you can look it up on Google if you're interested. But cook it. I like to take it off when it's rare at 125 and just let it rest for that 5 minutes to let the heat get from the outside back to the middle. And
what temperature do you cook it at?
Hot. I take my hand, and if I can hold my hand over it for just a second or two, and then I'll sear the sides and just kind of keep track of it.
He's on my favorite subject, so let's just continue with the steak conversation.
Got it.
Okay, for ribeyes, some people like the reverse method and to maybe cook them at a lower temperature, indirect heat for a little while. Can you explain that process?
Yeah, sous vide is kind of very popular right now where you cook at a low temperature for a long time and then you finish it on your grill to get that grilled flavor, that grilled taste. But kind of my go-to grill is the Big Green Egg. So many times I will do that reverse sear on there. So keep the temperature 300 or so and let it get done. And then I open up that grill and it gets hot really fast. So then I just finish it off on there.
One of the other things, too, I find that's an issue is seasoning with steaks. Mm-hmm. Some folks overly season it, in my opinion. And some folks don't season it at all. And I kind of like it somewhere in the middle, but I do like to keep it simple. Any recommendations?
Dude, this is a huge pet peeve of mine. Because, people give me seasonings galore. I have a cabinet full of seasonings. I don't use them. You know what I use? Yeah. Salt, pepper, garlic. And we call it our carnivore rub. And the easiest, we cook it. We create carnivore rub by the pounds. So the easiest way for people, their home use, is to take a heaping quarter cup of salt, and it can be that sea salt, granular sea salt. Then a tablespoon of black pepper, can be coarser ground, and then a heaping teaspoon of garlic. And you can adjust that garlic a little bit, shake it up, put it on top of your raw steak. I do that. I'll season both sides. And then let that kind of sweat in. And then
what's that mean?
Put it on the grill. So you've got your steak sitting out there. And the reason we call it a sweat is because that salt will start to extract proteins out of the raw meat. And so if you touch it, there'll almost be kind of a slurry on there. But it's not a gross slurry or anything. But it sweats in and it gets some of that salt in the outer surface. And that helps with that sear as you put it on there. Now, if you like other ingredients on there, if there are herbs you like to put on there, maybe wait on those because they're going to burn on the grill. And that's not going to be you're not going to get the benefit out of those herbs. But
how about butter on the steak while it's cooking?
You know, I've done that, but I'm going to buy a choice or prime grade steak, and hopefully it doesn't need butter.
Another question too, and this is more in the chef world, but there's a term called tempering, which I use for steaks. You know, you leave them out for a while. So if you're cooking them fast and hot, like we've been talking about, and the inside isn't raw, I mean, your steak is already warmed up, not to a cooking temperature, but explain that process a little bit.
Okay, first, since I work for the university and I'm a government employee, technically I have to give a food safety concern
okay.
at the beginning. However, Eric Berg, private citizen, loves to do that. And I like to do that more with like brisket as well, because if you temper it, bring it, you know, warm, I don't want to say warm it up, but bring it, leave it out in room temperature for a while that seasoning is sweating in. If you're smoking something, that tempering is going to allow the smoke to get in there a lot better. Let's go back to the steak. That one you got to be careful with, because if you're used to taking a steak out of the fridge and putting it on the grill, that's going to help for that purple center. You know, for those people that really like that rare center. If it's closer to room temperature, or if it's that 50 degrees or so, it's going to cook in the middle a lot quicker. So you're going to have to pay a little closer attention to that. But yeah, I like doing it. But I think of it usually more when I do a bigger cut of meat that's got a lot of lean exposed, like that I'm going to smoke, like a brisket.
Bone in versus bone out techniques.
Okay, having that bone in there is going to conduct some heat along there, and it's going to save that heat, so that resting process is going to have a greater heat increase because the bone is going to dissipate some of that heat. Sometimes your degree of doneness is going to vary across. It'll be more done closer to the bone going to the outside. So again, it's something you got to pay attention to. Somebody just loves it. Some people just love their bone-in steaks and chops. The tomahawk steaks have really gotten popular, I've seen. But those are thicker, and you kind of cook them more like a roast or so, something on the grill. So they're a little less finicky than a inch thick steak that might have the bone in it.
You've mentioned it two or three times. Give us a quick science lesson on the importance of resting. What is it and why is it such a big deal?
Yeah, you're taking that steak off of very high heat, so 550 degrees, and the exterior that has been exposed to that heat is going to be dry. So if you pull it off, or here's another big no-no. I see a lot of people check their degree of doneness by cutting into their steak. You don't want to do that because it's still on the grill, so don't do that. And don't use a fork. So I'm going all over the place here, but use a tongs to turn or even a spatula. But the resting process then is you can tent it. So you could take tin foil and tent. You don't, if you put a cover, like a pan cover over it, or if you wrap it in tin foil, all that heat stays trapped in there and your temperature is going to rise. It could even rise 15 to 20 degrees if it's completely wrapped. But we rest it so that the that the moisture that got pushed to the center from that high heat dissipates to the outside, and it makes it a lot less, it makes it a lot more juicy tasting.
And my son will take his brisket, and he'll it's wrapped in butcher paper, and then put blankets around it and throw it in his Yeti and let it rest for hours.
I do
too. Is
that
a good idea?
That's yes, that is a good idea. See, that's trapping the heat and the moisture. So there, maybe he might put some butter in there, or maybe my trick is cherry Coke. So I finish my brisket by, I'll put it in a pan so I can have some cherry Coke, and then I seal it up, and then that cherry Coke kind of adds a little more flavor. During the smoking process, I spritz with diluted tart cherry juice, and it doesn't bring a big fruity flavor at all, but that cherry enhances the beefiness, and so that's kind of been my go-to. When I lived down in Texas, they used Dr. Pepper a lot. I'd see people injecting Dr. Pepper into their brisket before they would smoke it, and that adds a little more kind of sugary and that whatever Dr. Pepper is.
It's kind of spicy. Dr.
Yeah,
Pepper.
Yeah. I think it's prune juice, carbonated prune juice.
Watch out. Craig, when we had Bert Myers in the studio from Beer and Fish in Dempsey's, he talked about using Coke when he cooked his corned beef with, well, not the cabbage and carrots and potatoes, but his corned beef for St. Patrick's Day. He would put a can of Coke in the roasting pan. So this all, it's really interesting. And Coke is good as a barbecue sauce, so is Dr. Pepper if you reduce it down in a saucepan. And soda can be used for numerous uses, that's for sure.
And it doesn't have to be Coke. You can get the off-brand, just any cherry cola. But I don't know, I just grab the Coke.
Shasta
cola. Yeah.
Let's talk about different grills. We've okay. really got into steaks and beef and that sort of thing, but there's infrared grills, gas grills, charcoal grills, electric grills, flat top griddles. You talked about a Big Green Egg. I'm a big fan of those, and just a simple Weber kettle grill because they're inexpensive and they work. So I'm guessing that charcoal is probably your preferred method.
It is.
And talk a little bit about why that is.
I just like the flavor of meat cooked over charcoal. And if we tuck a little bit of the science behind that, the reason that they say that a gas grill and a charcoal grill are going to have the same flavor on your hamburgers is not necessarily the heat you're using. It's that the juices from the beef fall on those fake briquettes in your gas grill or on your actual, and it creates an aerosol of the aromatics that impart themselves on the bottom of whatever you're cooking. I just think that whatever's in those briquettes, whether you're using lump charcoal, organic, or Kingsford, something else comes from that, too, to add a little more flavor to me. But we're going to find out on the 19th. We're going to do the official taste test. But yeah.
Do you add in any wood chips or chunks? Sometimes I do that, and I'll pick oak chunks up or apple chunks up in people's yards sometimes and use it.
Yeah, I have done that. And in the Big Green Egg, it's going to smoke because of the type of charcoal you have to use, that lump charcoal. And there was a time everybody had a Weber kettle, you know, and I still have one that I've had for, 25 years. So they last. They're good. And I saw in one of the ads, the Weber kettle, the standard one you think of on the tripod, is still under $200. So, you know, that's handy. If you like to pick up and go to the lake or go to the park, you can throw that in the back of your truck and go. A Big Green Egg weighs 200, 300 pounds. You can't do that. Your gas grill is also pretty heavy, so a Weber is pretty handy if you're on the go. So I like that. And what it comes down to is personal preference. I think most people have a gas grill because they can turn it on and it's ready to go. You know, so it's that convenience of cooking on that. You got to wait. So patience is in short commodity, I think, in today's culture. So I think that's why the Weber grill has been replaced more with a gas grill over time.
And I think the big benefit to the Big Green Egg or those ceramic Kamado style grills is insulated heat.
Yes.
And Weber, there is some ceramic coating on it, but it's not insulated. And so a Big Green Egg just holds in heat. And I think there's an appeal with the accessories are really neat, although a Weber has a lot of fun accessories too.
Yeah, yeah. And the charcoal is a little more expensive, but because of that component that you're talking about, you can dial in the temperature. And when you're done with your cooking, you shut it down and you reuse what's left of that charcoal. So it goes a lot further than your Kingsford that you put on and you burn it up every time. So that's a benefit. So let's talk pellet grills too, because that's kind of the bridge between convenience and barbecue. The guys that own their Traegers or Green Mountain pellet grills, any type of pellet grills, get kind of pissed if you say it's the easy bake oven of barbecue. But it is so convenient and it's so delicious.
It is easy.
That
I'll
you
chime in right there. Yeah.
You set it and forget it. And the Big Green Egg is like that a little bit too. But you can't just set a timer and it shuts off. The convenience of barbecue with a pellet grill is really nice. And they've come a long ways. When they first came out, we had one we took on the road and just bouncing it around a lot. The auger system would get jammed up and things, and the legs were real flimsy. So they've beefed them up pretty well, and you know, a lot of people have them, and they are delicious. Love to put a pizza on there. You know, I heard one guy that would take ice cube trays, so metal ice cube trays, put the water in there and smoke the water and then freeze it and put it in his old fashioned.
That's a really good idea.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. So I read at CES, the Consumer Electronics Show, last year, that there are some smart grills that actually have AI built into them now. Guessing maybe you haven't experienced them yet, but it can do things like, yeah, mine, I can control with my phone and yeah, I can turn it up, turn it down, do all that kind of stuff. But this thing is like that on steroids. It makes adjustments during cooking. You press a button and it goes and stuff. Anything new tech that is really cool, or do you just want to forget about all that new tech and just do it the way you've been doing it forever?
I have not seen anything like that yet, Craig, but so I grew up on the Terminator movies. I don't know if I want robots cooking my food. It might be how they start getting rid
of us. I'm with you there. Yeah, I'm with you there.
Well, let's talk a little bit about this upcoming event, and then we can close out this segment.
Yeah, I mean, the event, as I understand it, is May 19th. It's at Family Wellness. What time does it start? Is there a fee to attend? And again, give us the gist on what's going to happen, Dr. Berg.
Yeah, it starts at 5 o'clock. And, you know, we have a little leeway because a lot of people get off work at 5 o'clock. So we just kind of wait for everybody to show up. And there is pre-registration, and Family Wellness will charge a fee. I have to go to their webpage to, it's $15 for members, $25 for non-members. So, yeah, you know, there's still seats available. It's a smaller, more intimate group. I forget what the cap is, but there are still some seats available. And the kind of the reason that we haven't been doing the barbecue boot camp is because we've lost some, you know, a lot of key personnel since COVID, and it just never came back. So it's kind of just me running the show on these events with Family Wellness, and they call them Meaty Mondays. And this will be the sixth one that we've had scheduled. We kicked it off in December with a prime rib workshop to get people knowledgeable on how to cook a perfect prime rib for their Christmas dinner. And that was a ton of fun. We did a reverse sear prime rib in that, actually. And
that's actually how I did mine this year.
Yeah.
Oh, it was good.
So yeah. We fed everybody a lot because we had two full prime ribs and we had like 12 people. So everybody got full steaks from both examples. And we compared a true prime rib, which is a ribeye roll, versus a less expensive cut, which is the same muscle but a strip loin. And so we did the reverse sear with the strip loin because it's a little bit thinner and flatter, so it cooks quicker. And most people couldn't tell the difference in the flavor anyway. So it's a good deal if you want to save a few dollars per pound around Christmas time to use a strip loin, and your guests probably won't know the difference.
Our guest on Prairie Plates today has been Dr. Eric Berg from North Dakota State University. He's in the Animal Sciences Department. He is a grilling barbecue expert, and it's been our pleasure to host you on Prairie Plates today, Dr. Berg. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks, Greg. Thanks, Rick.
Rick, it's been a pleasure.
We'll talk next week, Craig.
Happy grilling, everybody.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Martin Media, bringing Paula Poundstone, comic and regular panelist on NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, to the Fargo Theater on Friday, May 30th. Tickets and information at paulapoundstone.com.
This is Decoded Datebook for May 14th. The American economy was booming in the 1920s, but things weren't rosy for everyone. Farmers were in trouble. During World War I, farmers benefited from increased European demand for American agricultural products. Inspired by high demand and high prices, many farmers invested in more land and expensive motorized farm equipment. After the war, Europe resumed agricultural production, but American farmers were slow to cut back. Without the same demand from foreign markets, prices for agricultural goods plummeted. Unfavorable weather conditions added to the strain. The Dust Bowl of the Dirty 30s was still to come, but the Great Plains already faced significant drought during the 1920s. Disaster was just around the corner. In early 1924, Senator Charles L. McNary of Oregon and Representative Gilbert N. Haugen of Iowa introduced a bill calling for a federal farm board. It would purchase surplus agricultural products at pre-World War I prices. The plan had support from the Secretary of Agriculture and from corn and wheat producers, but Congress failed to pass it. Opponents claimed the bill would raise prices for consumers. Supporters disagreed. Haugen used the cost of bread to make his point. He said the wheat only accounted for 2 cents of a 10-cent loaf. The rest went to overhead and profit. If the bill added just 2 cents, the cost to consumers would be minimal. But on this date in 1926, Haugen admitted that while the bill included provisions to limit inflation, we assume the bill will raise the cost of living. The McNary-Haugen Farm Relief Bill lacked support in non-agricultural areas. Many feared it would raise prices, and critics argued it rewarded overproduction. Congress passed the bill in 1927, but President Calvin Coolidge vetoed it. It passed again in 1928, and Coolidge vetoed it again. The McNary-Haugen Farm Relief Bill was never enacted into law. Today's Decoded Datebook was written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Decoded Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota. We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
The Supreme Court will hear arguments in a case challenging the constitutional provision that guarantees citizenship to everyone born in the United States.
Citizenship under the 14th Amendment needs to apply in a way that is uniform across the country.
The dispute over birthright citizenship on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
All right, time to play along. Here are some clues to the identity of our guest at our first ever live in-session event.
Everybody be cool, this is a robbery!
You talking to me?
He's an importer-exporter, okay?
Get it? He is Rob, I assume that's short for Robert Port, the much-read opinion columnist and podcaster. And he'll be with us Thursday, May 22nd at 7 p.m. at the Craftwell Event Center in downtown Fargo. We'll be talking lots of legislature and other issues on the minds of North Dakotans. And if reading Rob Port has ever made you feel seen and heard or seething with disagreement, well, you'll get a chance to ask Rob anything you want. Just bring your North Dakota and Minnesota nice, please.
You have no call to get snippy with me. I'm just doing my job here.
You can reserve your free tickets now at prairiepublic.org.
And that wraps up this Wednesday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. We are deeply grateful that you spent time with us. Remember, you can hear this and all past episodes of Main Street at our website at prairiepublic.org or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Tomorrow on the show, it's skin cancer, which is the most common cancer in the United States, with melanoma as its deadliest form. Bad news, cases have tripled in the last 30 years, we'll air a conversation with Dr. Mark Holbert of the Melanoma Research Alliance. Plus, Matt Olean reviews the slasher movie, Clown in a Cornfield, and Dave Thompson and I will review this week's news here in North Dakota. Until tomorrow, we hope you have a great day, and we do look forward to seeing you again tomorrow right here on Main Street.